The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Welcome. Good evening. This evening is about IMC. We're going to talk about IMC, a little about its history, about what happens here, about the philosophy behind what happens here, and how that influences what goes on here. And so for some of you, I recognize many of you, so I know that many of you will probably actually know a lot of this this information, this what we're going to be talking about here. But there are some of you I don't recognize, and if there are any of you who are new here, in particular, I welcome you. It's nice. This evening will be, it could serve as a great orientation for IMC. We don't do this very often. I asked Gil the other day when the last time this happened was, and he said he thought it was 6 years ago that we did this. So it's been a while since we kind of reviewed, explored what's happening here at IMC, and in the intervening 6 years, there's been actually quite a bit of change. And so, but the philosophy and the history kind of remain the same. So we'd like to start with a little bit of history. And since this is a Buddhist community, we could say that the history begins 2,500 years ago with the Buddha. And I'll give like a 35,000-foot overview of the history of our lineages, or the threads, essentially, of the Dharma that have come to us that we're practicing here. Actually, it may be more like a moon's eye view. It's going to be a very, very high-level view. So the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago in India, and after he died, he had a number of disciples, a number of followers, and they kind of spread through Asia. And in that spread of the Buddhist teachings and practices through Asia, as Buddhism met different cultures, different lineages, different teachings became emphasized. And there are a number of different of those lineages. And the main lineage that we carry here is the Theravadin lineage, which in the term Theravadin basically means teaching of the elders. And the Buddhist scholars, many of the Buddhist scholars feel that this particular thread of the Buddhist teachings, of the ones that exist today, of the particular threads of the Buddhist teachings that exist today, this is the one that's closest to what the historical Buddha might have taught, probably taught. So the teachings are grounded in the texts, the oldest Buddhist texts called the Pali Canon. And we, both of us have had training in some of the central Theravadin traditions in Asia. The key threads that are coming to us, essentially the lineages are carried through the teachings. And so the lineages in IMC are coming because Gil and I have practiced in various lineages. And so the main Theravadin lineages come through Burma and Thailand. They come through, in Burma, Mahasi Sayadaw, one of the great meditation masters of the last century. He lived in the 50s. And one of the amazing things about Mahasi Sayadaw is that he didn't see a distinction in terms of the monastic and the lay practitioners. Well, he saw a distinction, but he didn't prevent the lay practitioners in Burma from having access to any of the teachings. And he created retreat centers. May have been one of the early retreat centers created in Burma through Mahasi Sayadaw. He wanted there to be the possibility for lay people to come and meditate and practice and get the same teachings that the monastics get. And we, I think, in the lay Western tradition owe a great debt of gratitude to Mahasi Sayadaw for opening the teachings to lay people. So both Gil and I have practiced in this tradition through Mahasi Sayadaw, through teaching, having been exposed to teachers in Burma. Did you actually practice with Mahasi Sayadaw? No. Okay, so practicing with some of Mahasi Sayadaw's students, Upandita, Sayadaw Ulakana, Ukundala. So there are many great meditation masters who trained with Mahasi Sayadaw, and many of the Dharma teachers in the Western Dharma, in the Western Insight tradition studied with these teachers in Burma. And this is essentially how the Western Insight tradition came to us. Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg all went to Thailand, to Burma, to India, and met the teachings through various teachers who often had this connection back to Mahasi. And then there's another thread of the Theravadan tradition that came through Jack Kornfield, which is from Thailand, the Thai forest tradition, through Ajahn Chah, another great meditation master of the last century. And his framing of the teaching was much more integrated practice. He emphasized meditation, but he also emphasized the Dharma in whatever we do. And so these lineages have come together here. And also the Zen tradition through Gil as our founding teacher here, studied in both the Theravadan tradition in Burma and in the Zen tradition, both in Japan and here in California. So we are kind of a blending of several lineages here, but the kind of foundational lineage is the Theravadan lineage, coming through many, many of our teachers. I mean, we both studied in Burma, and we also both studied with a number of the Western teachers who studied in Burma, so Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, and they carry that lineage as well. So the Dharma, that this Theravadan lineage really came to the West through Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, in the founding of meditation centers in Massachusetts, IMS, in California at Spirit Rock. And it's out of that ground. That was 35 years ago, I think, around 35 years ago, that Jack, Sharon, and Joseph came back from being so inspired by what they'd learned in the teachings in Asia, and decided to create retreat centers here. And this is the founding of something new, actually. They brought a perspective of lay teaching. So they had studied with monastics and brought the teachings to a lay community, primarily a lay community, and that this center has really grown up out of that tradition. We're a lay practice community with lay teachers, and this is relatively unusual in the history of Buddhism for lay teachers to be founding their own meditation centers, not so connected to monasteries. We have a connection, of course, with the monastic tradition, but we're not actually associated with a monastery. And that's what's unusual here in the West. This is a new form of Buddhism arising in the West through this lay tradition. There is a precedent for this, though. I just came across this the other day, looking in the suttas, that I found in a footnote somewhere in one of the texts that there were seven teachers at the time of the Buddha, each who had a retinue, seven lay teachers at the time of the Buddha, each who had a retinue of 500 students, where 500 basically is code word for a lot. It doesn't necessarily mean there were 500 students, but a lot of students. So there were lay teachers at the time of the Buddha, and I found that an interesting reflection. So, do you want to talk a little about your background?
So Andrea Fell and I are the primary teachers here at IMC, and so part of what IMC is partly been shaped by how we've practiced and our experience in the Dharma. And so for me, I started practicing when I was about 20, and it took me a while to get serious about it. I think probably 22. And then I started practicing every day, and my introduction to it was, in a serious way, was to the Zen tradition, and I was a very happy Zen student, primarily because the Zen meditation was so meaningful for me. And because the Zen meditation was so meaningful, I wanted to kind of go deeper, and the way to go deeper was to go to a Zen center. And so I kept wanting to go deeper, and so from living in San Francisco, I went to the monastery, and from the monastery in San Francisco, here in Carmel Valley, I went to Japan and practiced in the monasteries there. And as I kept going deeper, to Zen, eventually I was ordained as a Zen priest. And then as I continued, but at some point I was introduced to this Vipassana practice, first in Thailand and then in Burma. And it was very meaningful for me to do this particular practice, probably the most meaningful meditation practice that I've done. And I didn't kind of reject the Zen practice. It wasn't like apostate or something, but there's no conflict between them. But I was very happy with the Vipassana teaching. I came back to this country and continued a little bit with. Came back a little bit to this country and continued with Zen. Did Vipassana, this practice, and more, and back and forth some. Eventually went to graduate school in Buddhist studies. And then was invited to become a teacher both in the Vipassana tradition and in the Zen tradition. And so I got that training, so now I'm qualified to teach in both. And then in 1990, when I came to do a doctoral program here at Stanford, I was invited to lead the small sitting group that was meeting in Palo Alto that slowly over these last 23 years grew to this center here.
And then a little bit about my history. I came to the Dharma more recently. I think I was 30, 37, 38 when I met the Dharma. And I dove in really fast, really quickly. I was in the Peace Corps when I met the Dharma, and a friend had sent me a book, and I just began practicing on my own, primarily in daily life. And so my first primary practice was actually daily life practice without any teachers, so I kind of found my way on my own. And then when I got back from the Peace Corps, I had actually started sitting, but I got back from the Peace Corps and I was introduced to Gil and began sitting retreats, and I kind of dove in head first. And I think I did 50 days of residential retreat that first year I came back from the Peace Corps, and then started going on 3-month retreats. And then I was drawn to go to hear my teacher's teachers, so I went to Burma for a few months. I've been to Burma several times now, studying with Upandita, Ujjanaka, and Saira Utejaniya, another lineage that's coming in here to this center. I think it was about 2004, Gil started training me to be a teacher. And it was one of my trips having come back from Burma. And I came back from Burma, and I had been managing retreats at Spirit Rock and started managing retreats in Burma at a retreat center in Sagaing Hills in northern Burma. And Gil had invited me to start teaching. So that began my teacher training, and then also was invited into the Spirit Rock teacher training program. And I don't really remember. I think it was about 2002 when I gave my first Dharma talk here, something like that. So it was about 11 years ago that I gave my first Dharma talk. What else? The last piece I'll just say about myself now is that I'm not only teaching here at IMC, but I'm now on the Spirit Rock Teachers Council. And so I'm involved in quite a number of programs up there. In particular, I'm the guiding teacher for the next Dedicated Practitioners program, and I'm participating in the teacher training program that's going on now. So my life has become completely teaching oriented in the last four years or so. I had to let go of my computer work to become a full-time teacher. And now Gil's going to talk a little about the history of IMC.
So as I said, I came into this group in 1990, and it was a pre-existing group. It started in 1986 in Menlo Park. And by 1990, it had moved to the Presbyterian Church in Palo Alto. And it was a small group. I remember it being 12, 15 people, met in a small room. And I'd come, you know, my primary influence in kind of growing up in Buddhism was some of the attitudes or understandings of being a practitioner that I learned from Zen Center, through Zen. And but also kind of, it's in the whole Buddhist tradition, certain kind of attitude that you don't teach unless someone asks you to teach. You don't really want to be a teacher, exactly. It was kind of what I'd learned. And so the ritual of that is you don't teach until someone, it's a ritual, you don't have to do this, but you don't teach until someone asks you three times. So I was asked to help take over this group because the facilitator for it had gotten sick. And so for the first couple of years, year and a half, I considered myself a guest. I'd been guest teacher. I'd been asked to teach there, and I wasn't going to do anything unless they asked me to do something. So I showed up every Monday. And also from my Zen training, I learned that it was really valuable to be rooted in one place, that somehow when a teacher or a practitioner keeps showing up over and over again, that it creates a stability and it supports people in their practice, because it's so easy to kind of wander off and not really be grounded. So I kind of made it a commitment to just keep showing up every Monday and teaching as much as I could. And for the first probably 9 months, there was no financial support for this, because that wasn't, I didn't think about that, they didn't think about that. But after about 9 months, there was they had collected a basket to pay rent to the Presbyterian Church, and I think there was $75 surplus after 9 months, and so they had a vote and discussion what to do with this money, and so then I was given it, and that was the beginning of financial support for this, and then but after about probably a year and a half, 2 years, I realized it was kind of a fiction that I was the guest teacher there. And that I should only do things if I got invited, because I was there long enough and steady enough that the invitation to be a teacher for the group was kind of implicit that I was supposed to take a leadership role. And the leadership role I found very interesting and eye-opening for me. It took me a while to learn this. But one is to get because I was the most senior practitioner, the most experienced, to have some sense of what was possible for people in their practice. And then help create the opportunities for people to step into that possibility of growth. So the simplest thing was, after a year and a half or something, the idea that these people have been meditating regularly now for some time, it would be really, they have the potential now of going further by having a one-day sitting, a one-day retreat. So I suggested we have a one-day retreat. And then I did a weekend retreat, and we started doing different things. And various classes in metta, loving kindness practice, classes in the precepts. And so at some point it became clear that part of my role was to be a little bit of a visionary, to have a vision of what was possible so people could grow into it both as individual and as a community. So at some point it became clear that the Monday nights were too... we moved to a new place, the Friends Meeting House. We got really packed Monday. And people started talking about, we should find a bigger place so we can grow even more. And I was reluctant to grow bigger that way, because we were about 100, 110 people would come Monday nights. And that felt enough to me. I didn't like the idea of having to speak to a bigger group. Partly I was worried about the dynamics that would happen if I was sitting in a room full of 200 people. I didn't think it would be good for my head. And I thought it was better to be kind of a little bit smaller. And so instead of doing bigger Monday, we started a second group on Thursdays. And then at some point we started a third group on Sunday mornings in Portola Valley. Then around 1996, I started having a clear sense that having a spiritual home for ourselves would be really useful for this community. There's a way in which, you know, one thing, if you just show up at other people's place, you're renting a room for Monday night, you have to set it up and you have to leave it, and you can't use it whenever you want, and you don't have associations to it, like it's your place to go and just be at in your own home, like you, right? And so I could see that this community of people would grow and develop in important ways as a community, as individuals, if we had our own center. And so then we went through the process of incorporating. Steve Gassner was part of that process. And in 1997, we were incorporated as a church in preparation for the possibility of having our own place. At this time, we were using, in any given month, we were probably using five different facilities around the peninsula. We were using the Friends Meeting House twice a week. We were using Portola Valley once a week. We were using either St. Mark's Church in Palo Alto for one-day sittings once a month. And we were, and someone was letting me use a space in someone's home in Menlo Park for my office. And then we rented a couple times a year. We rented Jokoji Zen Center up on Skyline. So we were kind of moving around all the time and doing all this stuff. And having the office in Menlo Park was good, because before that I would, the good time of the year, I'd meet with people one-on-one in parks in Palo Alto. And in the wintertime, I'd meet with them at a kind of restaurant, coffee shop called Cafe Verona. And people would be sitting there, you know, having an interview with me, like, you know, and crying, because, you know, talking about some deep issue in their life. And it was a little bit awkward to be, you know, to have this, you know, your counseling, your, you know, in it. So then I had this office in Menlo Park for a while. It was very nice. And so then we started looking for a place, and through good support from our community, and through we found this place here and could afford to buy it. And it was very important for us, because the all dana, all donation things is very important for us. It was very important to be very careful about the financing of this, so that we never want to be in any kind of financial pressure, because we don't want to make decisions based on, oh, we have to make more money. So we were only going to buy a church or place like this if we could have enough money in reserve to have a buffer. And so we were able to do that. So I think, I don't know how long the buffer was, but it was like for 3 or 4 years that we could pay our basic expenses without having to worry. Yeah, so we had a mortgage, but then a mortgage we paid off in like 3 years, really fast. No, we paid it off in like 3 years. And 2001, we moved in here. 2002, by 2005 at least, the latest, we were finished. So we own this building outright, and now. And it's been true that having this place here has allowed us to grow in beautiful ways. And we've done kind of slowly. You know, we're still adding programs, this and that. Let's try this, let's try that. And so slowly things have grown over these 11 years that we've been here. Also a growing community of seasoned, experienced practitioners. Some of them now, a good cadre of them, are now beginning to teach here as well. So it's been very satisfying to have this grow and develop. We are, and so then early on in that process, maybe around 2004, 2005, we started having a vision about having a place to hold retreats of our own. We were offering many retreats, anywhere from 3, eventually to 7 a year we offered. But the places we had to rent were both expensive, and also they weren't available as freely as we would like to have them. And we would like to be able to offer more retreats and have it more in our style. And so we had this vision about having our own retreat center. And then in 2006, someone came forward with a very large gift to us. It's a little bit unexpected. That would make it possible for us to begin pursuing this dream of having a retreat center. And we spent 5 years looking for property and raising more money. And then in, I guess, 2.5 years ago, we found this property in outside of Santa Cruz that we bought and renovated. And back in November, we started the Insight Retreat Center. So IMC has grown quite a bit, because not only do we have this building here and this community here now, we have the separate property in Santa Cruz that IMC is the caretaker for. So that's kind of the growth and development kind of quickly for us here.
Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Gil mentioned the idea that the teachings being offered freely is important to us, and that he just said that in brief, and I know he's going to talk about that a little bit more. But that has been a really foundational principle here at IMC, to offer the teachings completely freely. It is a little bit unusual in our lineage, in our tradition here, this Western Insight tradition, to offer everything completely freely. And it impacts not only just the flavor of how teachings are offered here, but that it also connects to the way that we want to make our teachings available as widely as possible, as accessibly as possible. And so while we are a Buddhist lineage, and in fact this notion of offering things freely comes directly from the Buddha, so we can really appreciate that aspect, that was his way of approaching the teachings. But here, while our teachings do come through the Buddhist lineage, we're more focused on the practices than we are on Buddhism per se. Now the we do teach Buddhist teachings, but it feels to me more integrated in what's practical for our daily lives. How do we use these teachings for what we are dealing with day to day? And so it's not necessary to be a Buddhist to value the teachings of mindfulness, of loving kindness, of generosity, and of ethical conduct. And those really kind of being the foundational teachings that we connect to here, these four: mindfulness, loving kindness, generosity, and ethical conduct. And these really underscore the values that we hold. And these are universal values. They're not just Buddhist values. So it's not necessary to be a Buddhist to come here. You don't have to sign up to be a Buddhist to come here. There are opportunities for that in a way. I mean, we do offer a few things a year that are kind of more ritual based, but it's not at all necessary. And I don't see it as important for anybody to sign up to be a Buddhist. To value the teachings. I mean, the teachings of mindfulness, in particular the teaching of mindfulness, has really integrated through our culture. There's the mindfulness-based stress reduction, which came through Jon Kabat-Zinn, having practiced at the Insight Meditation Society with Joseph and Jack and Sharon. That has been an infiltration of mindfulness into our society, the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, mindfulness in education, so many different ways that mindfulness is coming into our society that we can actually appreciate that Buddhism has offered us this gift. But there's a lot of people who are gaining the value of these teachings without ever really knowing it comes from Buddhism. So it's not really necessary to sign up to be a Buddhist in order to gain a benefit from the teachings here. There are kind of two sides, in a way, to the mindfulness practice. There's the kind of basic teaching of mindfulness, which encourages us to be present in the moment, looking at what's happening here and now. And this is it's a beautiful training, it's a beautiful way to learn about ourselves and our minds and our psychology. And then there's another side of our practice, the practice that we explore here, that's kind of attuned to a goal, to the possibility of freedom, of awakening. And this, I would say, is kind of the two sides of the practice, mindfulness practice we offer are the present moment practice, or what we might call the psychological side of the benefit of the practice, and then a possibility of attaining or reaching a deep freedom, a deep peace. And that we could call the liberative aspect of the teaching. That the practices we offer here. To me, the liberative aspect of the teachings, the possibility for complete, full freedom from suffering, is an important part of my own practice. And I do, in the teacher's seat, I feel I hold that, but it's not what I'm always talking about. You know, a lot of what I talk about in the teacher's seat has to do with how do you work with anger in your daily life? You know, how can you be in a conversation with someone and maintain a sense of connection and rootedness in yourself so that there's the practice of mindfulness in the moment being a key part of our teaching? So these two, Gil talks about this in a way as being the present moment practice, the mindfulness in the present moment, and mindfulness is part of a future-oriented the aiming towards a goal in the future. And they may sound like they're contradictory or in conflict somehow, a teaching for just entering the present moment and a teaching towards a goal. But they really come together in the present moment in that we only can move towards a goal by following the path in the present moment. So our exploration here at IMC, we try to offer a range of programs, of teachings, of opportunities that cover the range of people that come to IMC. Some people come to IMC just hoping for a little bit of support in their daily lives. How do I talk to my partner? How do I get through a day at work without being so distraught? And some people come to IMC and after some time actually find they're so inspired they want to go off to a monastery in Burma and become a nun ordained or go off to become a monastic and really turn their life over to the Dharma. And so there's a wide range of people, and we want to be able to offer things that support whoever walks in the door. And I really feel like we do cover that range. There's, I'd like to just talk about some of the things that we offer. There's a range from beginning programs to, we hope at some point, teacher training. not just yet, but there's a wide range of programs and retreats that we offer here. So I'm just going to tell you some of what happens here. It's kind of mind-blowing to think of going from the Monday night sitting and then to the few sitting groups we had a week in the variety of places to what has happened, what has unfolded from having a center. What I'm going to describe here has unfolded because we have this place. And I think that's a beautiful reflection, just how much this home has allowed the Dharma to flourish. How much has come about. So our regular weekly offerings include a Sunday morning sitting, a Monday evening sitting, a Tuesday morning sitting, and a Tuesday evening sitting, along with a Tuesday night Spanish Dharma offering and a Wednesday morning half-day retreat, sitting and walking, kind of a little silent half-day retreat. And then yoga we offer Monday evening and Thursday morning. That's just our regular weekly offerings. And then 2-3 times a year we offer introductory classes which are available for all, but they're one of the main ways in, I think, for people to begin to understand the practice that we do here. If you just come to the Monday night sitting, it might take you a while to begin to understand what the practice is or how to engage in the meditation. So the introductory classes actually teach the practice of meditation. Then we offer one-day retreats, which is kind of an extension in a way of the introductory classes. We have daily life practice program, which I tend to be the one who's primarily teaching the daily life practice program. Twice a year I offer a non-residential daily life practice retreat, and for people who have attended that non-residential daily life practice retreat, there's the opportunity then to join an ongoing daily life practice group, which offers a few other opportunities for exploring daily life practice. There's a Dharma practice program, which is a monthly meeting, usually from September through June or so, which explores, it's a day-long meeting that happens once a month, which explores themes in depth. This year we're doing the Eightfold Path. And the addition that happened this year with these Dharma practice days is that you could, how many people signed up for the?
About 30, I think.
About 30 people signed up to participate in a mentoring program, where they would have the opportunity to meet with mentors once a month to explore the theme of the month in more depth. So there's a number of the senior practitioners here who are serving as mentors in that program. There are neighborhood groups that we've coordinated. Those, I think, we have that periodically going on. We just started another round of neighborhood groups recently, but I know some neighborhood groups, and these meet in people's homes. Some neighborhood groups have been going on for years. They start with one of these kind of organizings that we do here, and then they just keep going. We have family programs. This is one of the great areas of the flowering of the Dharma here. We have the Dharma Sprouts, which are the kindergarten through third graders, the Dharma Rocks, which are the third through fifth graders, the Dharma Tweens, which are the sixth through eighth graders, and the Dharma Teens, which are the high schoolers. And then we also have a mindful parenting program. In the family program, there are also occasional, about once a year, I think, for the last few years, we've been doing a family retreat, which has grown somewhat from the Spirit Rock family retreat. And the families here in this community said, could we have one of those? And so a couple of years ago, Gil had the first one of those, and that's continuing. The next one will be this month at Jikoji. There are support groups for people with chronic illness, life-threatening illness, Buddhism and the 12-step. There are social gatherings through Dharma Friends. All of these programs have happened usually because someone said, could we do this? Could we have this happen? Could we have a family program? And initially, I think they would come to Gil and say, would you do a family program? And he quickly realized, I think, that he couldn't do everything. And so part of the way this has all flowered is that when people have come with ideas, Gil has very wisely said, would you like to lead it? What can we do? How can we make it happen without me doing all the teaching? And so all of these programs have happened because someone has come up and said, could we have this, and then been willing to step forward into some kind of a leadership role. And so that's been a big part, and Gil will talk more about that aspect, actually. That's a big part of practice here at IMC, is the involvement in volunteering, in finding the way that the Dharma for you wants to express itself. And that may be for you just sitting quietly in the room and not talking for a couple of years, or it may be that there's an inspiration that you have that you'd like to share with the community. There are also other kind of programs that are kind of tangential, but still very integrated with IMC. There's the Audio Dharma website, which has really flowered. That was another. Gil is a true visionary. He didn't think he was a visionary, but he is a true visionary. I don't know when he came up with the idea. I think it was called Radio Dharma initially.
Radio Buddhism.
And he told me, I have this idea about Radio Buddhism. What do you think? And I thought, what is that going to be about? I don't know. That's kind of strange. But it's flowered into this amazing thing. Basically, Audio Dharma has pretty much all the recordings of most events that happen here, including this. We're recording this. This is going to go up onto Audio Dharma. We record daylongs. We record pretty much everything that happens here. And so that's a resource that offers courses. It offers Dharma talks. And there's this, now we have this entire widespread community that's all over the world, actually, of people who listen to talks from IMC and feel like they're part of this community. Every now and then somebody will come into my sitting group and they'll come up to me and they'll say, they're kind of looking around wide-eyed and they're saying, I'm from Australia and I've been listening to you for 2 years and I'm here. I can't believe I'm here in IMC. So there's this kind of really widespread network, and we're seeing that too with the new retreat center, people coming to retreats who from all over the country who are thrilled to be coming to meet us face-to-face and to meet the community that they've been participating in for all these years. So we also offer an online introductory course a couple of times a year through Audio Dharma, which meets, again, you know, people from all over the world sign up for that. I think somewhere between 150 and 250 people sign up for that course when it's offered. It's, again, a way that the Dharma is reaching out from this center. We have way more impact on the world than is outwardly visible. It's quite amazing. Then the Sati Center is another vision of Gil's, which provides more of the Buddhist kind of side of the training, more of the sutta-oriented, the actual teachings, the actual kind of, perhaps we could say, I can't think of the word.
The study
of Buddhism. And in the Sati Center, we have these Buddhist study daylongs. We may offer some retreats at the new retreat center. Is the Inalio retreat actually a Sati Center?
Yes.
So, yeah, we're having a retreat in a few weeks that will be the first Sati Center retreat, which will be offered by a monastic, a study retreat on the foundations of mindfulness. And the Sati Center also is the home for a chaplaincy program. Another one of Gil's visions. He really is this little fountain of ideas. I won't talk too much about the chaplaincy program. And then more recently, another aspect of the Sati Center has been the creation of a Sati Institute for Buddhist Studies, which is offering a master's degree in Buddhist studies in conjoining with the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. So this is partly connected with the idea of chaplaincy, because Buddhist chaplains generally get a master's in divinity in order to become chaplains, and there wasn't quite a way to do that. And this, I think, was part of the founding of this idea, the finding a way for the Buddhist chaplains to get this kind of master's in divinity training. And then we have retreats, which I'll talk more about later.
With us? It's been an hour or so, hopefully still engaged. It's kind of an amazing thing that we start from this little thing in Palo Alto or Menlo Park, and we've grown up to be so much here. And sometimes I think maybe easy to take it for granted. We're an established institution, and I still remember we were just little, you know, all we had was a key that would open the door. And so we've grown quite a bit. There was a time in the mid-1990s where I said we had to stop growing. And I declared a moratorium on growth. That didn't work well. So one of the opportunities with owning a building like this was to enhance the sense of a community, that we're a community of people practicing together. And for me, I think of us as IMC as practice-focused rather than teacher-focused. So even though it's a little unfortunate the way we set up here is that, you know, it's a kind of half circles, you know, the focal point is kind of, sometimes the teacher is not even the Buddha. And it's kind of a little bit efficient that way in terms of my preferred way would be all sat in a circle, but then we need a bigger building and bigger loudspeakers. But the idea of a circle is that we're all in it together, we're practicing together, and the teachers are practicing just as well as everyone else is practicing, and we're sharing the practice. The practice is at the center, not a teacher. And also, in a sense, not the teachings either. The teachings are important, but the teachings are here to support the practice and the practical benefits that come out of here. And it's a time-honored Buddhist idea that practicing community is very supportive. It's one thing to practice alone. It's another thing to practice with other practitioners, where you bump up against each other, you learn from each other, you can have conversations about the practice together. You can be in conflict with each other in a good way, in the sense that good way means that it's a place you can kind of talk about the conflict and work it out, because the commitment, I hope, for a Buddhist community like ours is we never turn our backs towards anybody. But, you know, it doesn't mean we don't have conflict, but then we meet and try to discuss it and work it out. And so part of that, not turning our back towards anybody, is always having the door, when it's unlocked, we have programs, anybody can come in here. And we try to be welcoming, even though some people don't feel very welcome when they come here, because, you know, we're kind of quiet. No one greets them. But eventually, I think people stay, come long enough, it feels like a friendly group of people. But we don't want to shun anyone. And we've had people come in off the street who were a little challenging for some of us. And I've tried to create a situation where we hold them as a community and make space for them, rather than saying, you know, you can't be here. So the idea is to be inclusive, accepting of people, to be open and have the community part important part. So we've created a community meditation center, and it's been very satisfying to do this in Redwood City. It could have been elsewhere. But one of the satisfying things has been how many people from the local community here run into us and by just driving down the street, and then they say something like, oh, I've been looking for something like this for years, or, you know, I can't believe that's right in my own neighborhood. And so many people do this here in Redwood City that I think there should be a place like this in every town, because I think there's probably interest like this all over. And that's kind of my vision is I would rather have more, and this is a relatively small church, if you call it a church, and more of these small places sprinkled around the peninsula than to have, you know, a mega church, you know. I think it's something healthy about the size, because the size helps create community. And I think our success as a center has a lot to do with having created a sense of community that is fairly porous and pretty adaptable to the different needs that people have. There are people who've told me that how meaningful it is to come here, because for years they can come and sit in the back and no one bothers them. No one asks them or anything. And they just like to come someplace. The only place they can come in public where people leave them alone. And other people come in here and say, this is an unfriendly group, because they want it. They're extroverts maybe, and they want people to greet them. And so it's a little bit, it takes a while then to make the connection. But then people do make a connection here. And one of the great ways to make a connection, to kind of enter into the community in a deeper way, is to be a volunteer. And I think a good percentage of the people who do offer to be volunteers do it because they want to be part of a community in a more kind of integrated way. The idea so one of the aspects of Buddhism, one of the ways Buddhist teachings or philosophy has been divided sometimes is between that part of Buddhism that has form and that which is formless. And form is often rituals, robes, particular ways of techniques of practice, ways of holding yourself. the temples, Buddhas, you know, all the forms, all the stuff and the behaviors you can see. Form meaning what you can see. And the formless is what you can't see. It doesn't have a physical form that or behavior that you can watch. And liberation is usually understood to belong to the formless realm. It doesn't really, it might be expressed in behavior, might be expressed in what you do and what you create, but that it's a liberation and freedom of heart that has no form. And in that that formless space of freedom, of awareness, of compassion that might be there, that's the deepest and the fullest teachings and or the kind of possibility of this practice here. So little bit, partly to align ourselves with this kind of formless dimension of what freedom is, we're a little bit formless here at IMC. We don't have a lot of form. Some people bow, but it's not required. We have a Buddha, but some people say that in much of the lighting, it's so dark you can't even tell what, you know, it's kind of disappears in the darkness. And we don't have robes and we ring bells at the end of the sitting, but, you know, there's not a lot of rituals and, you know, stuff that goes on here, just a minimal to kind of, for good people to kind of get along together. So that's primarily for two reasons. One is, but the main one, the important one, is that it's meant to express the formless nature of freedom itself, not to be bound by a form. And some people say that that kind of teaching and approach is actually a much more difficult way of learning than when you have a lot of forms, because then it's really up to you. The other side of that formless is that to be a little bit casual. And so we're by design here casual as well, not only because it expresses the formless aspect of freedom, but also because to make it relaxed and easy for people to come and feel comfortable here. And not only for people who are not interested in Buddhism and for many reasons, but also because as a meditation center in a community, in a urban, suburban area, people work, people have family and obligations of many kinds. We want to like it to be people feel comfortable in coming and going as they need to. So we don't really tell people to you don't have to come on time to be here. You can leave anytime you want. And so I've had people who are used to other Buddhist centers say, "Gil, we have to have strong, you know, close the doors and lock the doors from the beginning of a sitting, so no one, if they're late, they're, you know, they have to learn how to come on time." And it's a useful way to teach that way, but I think it's in order to make it accessible to the kind of life that people live here, we have it. One hand, it looks casual. Another hand, it's expressing something very deep and profound about the nature of freedom itself. And part of that then is the freedom of liberation, the openness of liberation, the open-handedness of it, goes along with this idea that we offer everything freely here. And it's partly a practice for everyone here, especially for the teachers, to show up and just teach freely and not to be concerned about any kind of thing we might get in return, financial return for doing it. And that's our dedication, is to try to stay pure, clean as we can with that and offering it freely. And so everything here is offered as freely. We don't charge for anything here. And not only don't we charge, as probably most of you realize, it's actually fairly rare that anyone talks about that even. You pass the dana box, the donation box, every time you leave. So, you know, it's kind of obvious, but my kind of hope for this is that people would come here and feel quite relaxed and easy to come, and after someone's new, and after coming 3 or 4 months, they kind of look around and say, "What's going on here? That no one's asking for money. I mean, isn't that kind of unusual in our society?" And then the teachings of generosity, the teachings of open-handedness, the teachings of generosity and gratitude and goodwill that represents this, what we're doing here, somehow sink in deeper to the heart, and they understand something that they wouldn't understand if there was a monetary exchange. And so part of that is, I think, we want to cultivate in Buddhist practice an open, generous heart, because the generosity can also be something that expresses the freedom of not clinging and holding to things. And so much of what we're set up here is to help support that generosity for people to have it. And one of the ways is to volunteer. Everything that happens here, except occasionally, like last week, we had to call in Roto-Rooter. We paid them. We've had the kitchen remodeled. One of the members here who stepped forward and said, I'm going to offer to remodel the kitchen. And my labor is my donation to the community, but IMC paid for the parts. So there's a tremendous amount of volunteerism that supports this place. Years ago, we counted 150 volunteers, and anything from changing the flowers to people who, some people, like in the past, it's been like Reynes Friedman. It's like a full-time job she did, but she was volunteering herself. And so everything that's all the labor to run this place is run by volunteers. It's quite remarkable that it should work this way. And I wouldn't want it to have any other way. I'd rather have us shrink and become less because it's so meaningful and such a profound way of practicing the Dharma is to practice in that kind of field of generosity and goodwill that comes with it. In terms of the philosophy here of the Dharma, one of the aspects has to do with the nature of the teachers, how the teachers are seen. There's many different attitudes, understanding of the role of teachers in different lineages of Buddhism. At one end of the extreme is the guru model that you find in some traditions where you basically are obedient to the guru and you have to kind of turn your decision-making over to the guru and you're told what to do and there's a complete surrender to the teacher. The other end of the extreme is that the teacher is what's called a kalyanamitta, which means a good spiritual friend. So it's more like the feeling is more like their friend and supporter, their fellow traveler with you, who's maybe a little bit further along in the path, and they're kind of there as your friend and support. Work in that range from the guru to the good spiritual friend, we are closer to the good spiritual friend rather than a guru. I think both Andre and I are not particularly eager to be gurus, and probably were aversive to it, or frightened of the idea. But we're more kind of good spiritual friends. But where we are in that range varies. I would say for every person that we encounter, some people we're just kind of like peers with, and we share the practice together and have Dharma discussions with more. Some people we have a little bit more important role in their life and. And the relationship is sometimes quite strong. Sometimes there's some authority that people grant us in our role that seems appropriate to have. So it kind of varies and changes, but the default is we're good spiritual friends. In fact, my default is that I'm never a teacher until someone makes me one. Someone shows up and asks me a question, and then I'm a teacher for them. But otherwise, it's a student that makes the teacher, is my kind of feeling. Part of being a community center is caring for each other, and that's been something that we've tried to do and focused on a number of ways over the years. When it became clear that the community was too big for me to meet all the pastoral needs of the community, then we created a chaplaincy council that could go visit people when they're dying, visit people who are going through some major crisis in their life. If there are people who want to have a wedding, I used to do more weddings. I try not to do them anymore, but rather the other people in our community now who are sanctioned to perform weddings. And so memorial services, things like that. So we have a group of 12 people who have that role. To my delightful surprise, they haven't been called on very much in the last 6-7 years because not a lot of people have died or gone through this kind of transition, needed that kind of support, much less than I expected. But what the primary role this Chaplaincy Council has fulfilled is because of Audio Dharma, we get a lot of email from all over the world asking Dharma questions, sometimes of a very personal level, really needing help. And so the Chaplaincy Council are people who, some of them are therapists, some of them they all have some kind of training where they're suitable to engage and respond to those people and have exchange with them. We've tried various other ways of offering care. The support group for people with life-threatening illnesses and chronic illnesses is one way. We've tried to have a council of people who offer Sangha care available. In Santa Cruz, Vipassana group, it's called the Tofu Brigade. And, you know, to bring meals to people who are sick and stuff. And we've tried, I would say, very hard over many, many years, 12 years, to try to put together something that worked for us in terms of some kind of ongoing brigade or people, community. And we haven't figured out how to make it work. We've tried many different ways. So we've kind of given it up, trying to make the effort to have that kind of thing. It seems like many churches, for example, have something like that. Something about our community where that kind of hasn't worked very well for us. So what we've committed to now is more informally, hopefully to we know each other well enough that that if someone has a need, that somehow informally, as a community, we figure out. And if I learn about it, I try to organize something or find a way to do it. And because I think caring for each other is very important. It's just how to do it in an institutional way has been a challenge for us, given who we are. So then, again, a little more about the student-teacher relationship. It is historically in Buddhism very important, and we don't emphasize it so much here. We don't give a lot of teachings for it about how to do that, and we let it kind of evolve. And my attitude is mostly I just respond to people who come, and that relationship becomes what it is in response. We discover what it is as we respond. We negotiate it as we get together. But historically in Buddhism, having a student-teacher relationship is often considered very important. And a few things that works well here at IMC, I think, in order to develop that, is to show up a lot. showing up, something eventually I notice. And then show up and then come and talk, you know. It helps to be a little bit assertive rather than waiting for me or Andrea to do something. So, I mean, don't be too assertive, but showing up counts. Being a volunteer tends to help because then it's easier to kind of cross paths and talk to each other and things like that. And then going on retreats. So being on retreats that we teach is one of the primary ways of developing that relationship and getting to know each other in some deep ways. And then last thing about IMC, as we've taken root here in Redwood City, in this place, there is an individual practice that's important here. We support people to come as individuals and practice here. There's a practice of a community. Some people feel more connected to the community than others, but there's a growth and development of us as a community as well. And I think anybody who comes here benefits from that. Even if you sit in the back and never talk to anyone, there's a way by osmosis you can kind of feel the maturity of the people who are here. That was not the case 20 years ago. And it's quite impressive to come into this space and to feel so many mature people. But then there's also our community's relationship to the wider world. And at some point, we're going to grow up. I don't know where we are in the growing up phase. If we take the beginning of kind of our birth being in having a non-profit status as a church, that was 1997, so I guess we're 16. So we haven't grown up yet. But it's time to begin kind of aware that we're part of the wider world. And I feel, you know, that we have some responsibility to the wider world. We're citizens, in a sense, an institutional citizen in our community. And so how do we serve and how are we responsible members of our wider community, not only here at Redwood City, but the peninsula, but the world itself, is an interesting question as we keep growing and developing. And so there are a few things that, you know, we have... we've done a few things in the area. We try to respond the best we can to requests to come and teach Buddhism or meditation to almost anybody who asks. Schools and other institutions have asked us to come. Other churches have asked us. We try to do what we do here the best we can to be open to the community as a whole. We've done various efforts at service projects in the neighborhood and the community, wider community. I think we could do a lot more. It's pretty minimal, but we've done a few things. We've done things over the years for that way. A group of people from within IMC coming out of us, part of this effort, is also, you know, what are you saying about me before? Part of this vision. was the Inside World Aid. And the Inside World Aid is more like an international medical aid organization. Buddhists in America haven't really done much in this regard, and it feels like we're kind of ready to start kind of contributing to the world that way. It's kind of unfortunate. It's unfortunate you go to places like Cambodia, and there's a lot of aid organizations in Cambodia, and most of them are Christian, and which is great. It's not a problem, but the it's a Buddhist country, and it must be a little odd to the people there. Like, these Christians are coming and help us, and why aren't the Buddhists helping us? And we're just 16, right? So you can't expect too much from us. But as we grow, one of our efforts was this Inside World Aid, and a group of 28 people just came back from doing the first medical mission to Cambodia, which worked out really well. This Sunday, there's a presentation about that trip here. And so I think there's more possibilities for this. Actually, the Inside World Aid did a couple of kind of health fairs that they supported here in the Bay Area as part of their outreach. So I may say a couple of more things just to be really quick, because we won't have time for questions. So we have this great retreat center now, and it's been very important for us to have a retreat center because it's both a way for people to continue growing and developing. It's one of the primary ways in our particular meditation tradition that's, you know, for the growth of practice. You don't have to go on retreat, but it's historically that's really the source out of which these teachings come out of, and how our teachers have matured. So it's important for people to have this opportunity to do that. And also it is still this primary, we see it as a primary place to incubate the next generation of teachers. People who are going to teach and offer more is a chance to do retreats. So we see it as a part of our responsibility for the carrying this on into the future, and even for the care of IMC. So at some point, Andre and I will be long gone, and so we have to a little bit prepare for that. And so there's, you know, creating teachers and creating teachers. That's one of the important places to do that. And then we had the last thing to say was I still have vision. It's been a surprise to me that this is part of my role, because I feel like before I started being at IMC, I never was a person that had vision. I was kind of naive and just did my thing. But I felt that it was something that grew with this role. And as the community grew, it seemed appropriate to be a little bit ahead of the community with the vision, right? And that was part of my job and part of our job. You're not there yet. So I'll hand it to you. So there still is, you know, there's plenty of vision still around. I have no shortage of vision. Hopefully we'll hold it lightly and not get too ambitious about it. But one of the visions for us is to create a richer, wider mandala, collection of Buddhist practice programs, teachings, events, culture for this peninsula here, for us here. To give you a little, not that we're going to do this, but give you a little example. The early vision we had for having a center was to have next door a hospice that we would also care for, so that people who, in our community, in the wider community, who were dying, could come there and be taken care of in a nice environment. And cradle to death, kind of, the cradle to grave, offer a Buddhist culture so that people who are serious about the practice and really make it part of their life feel like they're met with what they want. It's been rather unfortunate, when people feel like they're committed to a religion or to a practice or to a community, and this, which has happened in some of the insight communities in the West, that they don't, they're dying. They've been coming for years, but no one really knows them, and the community's not really set up to offer anything. And there's no one who comes and cares for them, or no one offers any kind of ceremony or anything that supports them. Or people who get married and say, I've been coming for some years, can I have a wedding? And, no one's here to do it for you. And so it's important, I feel, to be able to meet people. So the idea is, so there's more we could do in terms of developing this Buddhist culture, Buddhist practice, kind of, for the full range of human life as people need it. Part of the vision also is, as I said, is I'm not that interested in growing bigger here. I like the size. I think having developing other sitting groups in the peninsula would be nice. And as some of the senior practitioners here have developed, they've been ready to have sitting groups. The latest one that was started by Kim, who's sitting in the back row. She started a sitting group in Los Gatos that meets Sunday mornings, and we've had other ones start in different places. We're packed here. It's hard, for us to offer more programs here, and there is more programs we'd like to offer. As we grow and develop, it'd be good to offer more things for a bigger, richer package of things. And we're packed. The schedule is packed, and we can't really offer much. So I don't know what to do about that. My dream is that we can have the building across the street, which is currently for sale, but I think it's too expensive. Or someplace really close by here so that we can have another space, another classroom, another place to have programs. The last part of that vision is that Andrea mentioned was at some point I think I've been teaching long enough and getting old enough that it seems like what's happening is I'm beginning to think about that part of my role is important part of my role is to empower, to support other people to teach and to help make opportunities for others to teach and look for those opportunities, develop those opportunities. And so part of the vision is both hopefully try to create more of that, but also to have a training program for teachers. And so I'd like to be able to, at some point, I'm kind of trying to prepare myself someday to be able to offer that in a stronger way. So, your questions, your comments. What did we leave out that was important to mention? What didn't we cover that you expected us to cover? Or do here today? Yes?
Earlier in the evening, you used the terms Theravada and Vipassana.
Vipassana.
Vipassana interchangeably. Are they in fact interchangeable?
No. Theravada is a really broad movement of Buddhism that it's hard to put exactly what it is, but it's the Buddhism of that is based on the earliest surviving teachings of the Buddha, and it's Buddhism of Sri Lanka, Burma, and Thailand. Vipassana is in the earliest teaching, Vipassana meant insight. That's why Insight Meditation Center. But it's come in the modern world to refer to a practice of mindfulness, a particular kind of practice. So the practice of Vipassana, people say, it's a practice of insight. And so then in America, sometimes in the modern West, some people call it the Vipassana tradition. I think of tradition taking hundreds of years to develop, not 40. And so some people will say there's three Buddhist traditions in America. There's Tibetan Buddhism, there's Zen Buddhism, and there's Vipassana Buddhism. It's kind of like a little strange to be a tradition, venerated tradition in that category already. It's also erroneous because there are other Buddhist traditions, lineages here that then are left out. Some of the biggest and most long-lasting is the Japanese Buddhist traditions. The Japanese Pure Land traditions have been here over 100 years and have churches all over. And also the Soka Gakkai. The Japanese Buddhists have a lot going. So by saying those are the three traditions, it leaves out a lot. But I think what the three have in common, when people use that expression, in America, Tibetan, Zen, and Vipassana tradition, they're kind of referring to the kind of more meditation-based Buddhism that arose out of was part of the unfolding of the counterculture in the 1960s. And whatever legacy that brings us.
Is it on? This is kind of a quick question about a volunteer thing. I noticed that there's a few things on Audio Dharma that have transcripts, but not everything, and yes. I wonder, is that due to lack of volunteers or a choice to not have them? Or
yeah, I think that if we had more volunteers, we'd probably transcribe more.
Yay. You have one.
Okay. So If there's a volunteer form on the counter, if you fill it out and make that clear, Hillary will contact you. That'd be great. Thank you. It's a great thing to transcribe because it's a way of letting the teachings go in deep. I transcribed some of the talks of my teachers in the 1980s. It's a way of really living with the teachings and kind of massage them as I did it. So as you know, maybe I've said this sometimes, you get really good karma in Buddhism for asking questions. Yes?
The small group that existed in Palo Alto, are any of those folks here tonight?
No. We've had a lot of continuity of people. But no one here from that time. Probably the person here. What? A small group in Palo Alto?
Before
me?
Yeah, or around.
Before
me.
Or
around
that
time.
There are people still coming. Bonnie Goodman came in 1990 when I started, and she's still involved here. And there's a variety of people. Brigitte Jelaine, who teaches here sometimes, was back then. Ursula was here. I don't know if Hugh McMillan might have been before me, and he comes still. Pesha. Brownings. I think he came around the same time as I did. But there are people. Bud Silver. He doesn't come so much. He has cancer now, so it kind of keeps him home more. But Bud Silver was before me.
I think we owe him a deep bow of thanks.
To those people.
Yeah,
those people are great. And it was a couple named Howard and Ingrid Noodleman who started it. And Howard was also at that time the president of Spirit Rock. So when we started here in 1990, when I started, this was clearly a satellite sitting group of Spirit Rock. And we put out the literature for Spirit Rock. I would make announcements for Spirit Rock. And we would do work days in Spirit Rock, go up there and help support them. And it was clear that we were kind of part of Spirit Rock. And over the years, in the early years, Spirit Rock supported us by listing us in their newsletters and stuff. And also they provided us with our liability insurance we needed for the places we rent. I think all through the 90s, all those five different places we used, they provided the liability insurance for us, as support for us. But as we grew and developed, we became more independent, and so now people can come here probably for a long time and not realize that there's a connection between us and Spirit Rock. And there's no formal connection, but there's a very strong informal connection. And this is one of the characteristics of the Insight movement. I call it the Insight movement that we're part of, the movement of Insight practitioners and teachers who come out of IMS, Spirit Rock, a place in England called Gaia House, that we're all part of. And we have meetings every 3 years where the teachers meet, kind of a teacher meeting. And so there's a lot of collegiality. The teachers teach together a lot. The emphasis on teachers on retreats where, four, sometimes five, six teachers can teach together. And the idea that we're a lot of peers working together is also somewhat a little bit unusual in the history of Buddhism. Most countries in Asia, you're an abbot or abbess, most likely an abbot, and you're like in charge. There's a clear hierarchy and what you say goes. And here in the West, there's much more this democracy and egalitarianism. And so the whole our scene is developed with this collegial peer relationship with the teachers, where the teachers have a lot of contact with each other, meetings together and teach together. And so it's been a very important part of Andre and I practice of being a teachers to also be connected to other teachers. And so like we're both in the Spirit Rock Teachers Council. And so that keeps us, connected in this peer group of support. So I don't know how I got to that. But anyway, so Howard Noodleman started it, and he was the one who got sick in 1990. And here's a nice story. So Howard Noodleman started the IMC, started what became us. And he asked me to take it over when he got sick. He was a doctor, and he had gotten interested in, very early on, before it was really that popular, John Kabat-Zinn's mindfulness-based stress reduction program. And before there was any teacher training for that, he talked to Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he was going to he was working at El Camino Hospital to set up MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction program, at El Camino Hospital. And then he got sick, right? So he turned the sitting group over to me, and this is what happened. He turned his fledgling efforts to start the MBSR in El Camino over to Bob Stahl. And Bob Stahl took that baby and grew it up. And Bob Stahl is now one of the premier MBSR teachers in the world, really, and developed in El Camino, and many people have been trained there, gone through that program. And so this one man, Howard Noodleman, you know, and his wife, their efforts kind of blossomed. And he died in the early 90s from his prostate cancer. But then his wife I didn't see for years and years. And then when we had, I think, a work day or an open house at IRC, she showed up, and she was working. She's coming now, and sometimes it works in the garden.
Thank you.
Yes, we can have a mic up here. You know, it's 9 o'clock, so maybe if it's okay, so you know there's an end. Maybe we'll take about another 6-7 minutes.
I went to IRC, and I thought it was a beautiful venue and very peaceful and lovely and contemplative, and I really enjoyed the retreat. I was wondering if you might have any visions or plans for a contemplative / meditative retreat there, or anything like that.
What is it? What do you mean by contemplative?
Contemplative, or writing, or something that would mix, or mindfulness discussion kind of retreat, as well as meditative based. So
we have actually already several kinds of retreats happening. Just this past weekend, we had what we called the Dharma Integration Weekend, where we did more of an in and out of silence. So it wasn't quite what you were describing in terms of, you know, writing or something like that. But the teachings were geared towards integrating the practice with our activities. And we're going to have a couple, I don't know if the plan is to have a couple of those a year. We have another one scheduled in July. And then we have the studies retreats that the Sati Center is going to be hosting, I guess. So we have one of those this year with a monk coming to teach that. And next April, Gil and I are going to teach one of those. We haven't come up with a theme yet, but we need to do that. And you know, there's always a possibility for other things. I've kind of got the idea of more of a daily life practice retreat going on in my mind. I have, you know, the daily life practice retreat here that I do, but I haven't quite formed the notion of what that retreat would be. Then we have, of course, the silent retreats, which are right now anywhere from a weekend to 2 weeks, and then we may take those to longer retreats. There's always the possibility for other kinds of retreats, so if you have a thought, you know, you're welcome to share it with us.
Yeah, I think slowly over the years we'll probably develop a variety of different kinds of retreats.
I'm on what we sometimes call the Karuna Committee in Insight Meditation South Bay, and we just had a meeting not long ago. And actually, last night you guys got mentioned in having a fair, like a volunteer fair or something like that. And we're looking into different ways of entry where we can kind of do compassionate work out into the communities and things like that. So I wanted to maybe, if you could toss out a few examples of what came out of that kind of thing. And then also, is the hospice, is that taking form beyond vision, or where is that?
So having a hospice, I think that's not much traction for that. But what Brigitte Gillain and a few people tried to do was, or they did, was they They had twice now a two-parts training program for people to offer a little bit contemplative care for people who are dying. And with the idea that to create a group of people who could be companions to people who are at the end stage of death, kind of meditative Buddhist kind of companions for anybody who requested it. However, there also there hasn't been any requests. So but what they have done, that group, so a few of them, is they've taken their interest in their training and going over to Hopkins Manor right next door here, and they go over there and meet with the residents there and offer something there. So that's as far as we've gotten with it. There is there's small little ideas of what we could do for our community. I mean, small things. Like one of the beautiful things that happens is that, for example, a small one is in November, December, we collect children's books here. And we offer it to disadvantaged children here in Redwood City who normally wouldn't get any books or those kinds of things. And so that's been a beautiful thing to do and very well received and appreciated by the people who receive the books. And then that's like maybe a relatively small thing. I'm going to have a conversation with someone tomorrow. I mean, it's kind of far-fetched at this point, but there's a local hospital that's pretty close to us that does not have chaplaincy services. Some hospitals have chaplains on staff who work there available to meet people. And it's a wonderful thing that interfaith chaplains offer to people. And so the idea is that we have this Buddhist chaplaincy training program, and that efforts are there, and also IMC's efforts can somehow be integrated into that local hospital, and we can have it wouldn't be appropriate to have a Buddhist chaplaincy program or offering. That's not appropriate, but that we would offer it. Like in San Francisco General Hospital, it's the Episcopal Church sponsors the chaplaincy services there. So perhaps there's some way that Sati Center and IMC could be involved in providing chaplaincy services, interfaith services, at this local hospital. So that's kind of grandiose. So,
well, I mean, obviously the mention of hospice in conjunction with the Sati Center, that chaplaincy is... It's pretty delightful to have something like right there if that were to happen. And I'm also thinking that probably the people that would be interested in the companion with death might have been getting sucked up into the chaplaincy training and, you know, as well. So they might be there. They're just going to somewhere else.
Okay. Since it's getting late, I think it's time to stop. So, but I would like to have a request from all of you before you go. And that is, I'd like to know all your names. And I probably won't remember, but it's part of my practice to try to get to know people and know, so hear the names. Maybe if I hear it a few times, it slowly starts to stick. So it'd be okay if you go ahead, maybe with the mic. Where's the mic? If you maybe start with you, Lisa. And then, but is it probably not on?
Test?
Yeah.
Lisa?
Penny.
Tanya. Lynn. Judy.
Sandy.
Tom.
Arthur.
I'm Dan.
Kim.
Laura.
Joe.
Jessica.
Susan.
Jim.
Marjorie.
Beverly.
Jim. Glenn.
Edna.
Paul.
Tal.
Roberto.
Kyle.
Kurt.
Steve.
Ellen.
Steve.
Evelyn.
Lauren.
Steph.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I hope this was meaningful for you to come. It's been a bright light, a very important, surprising part of my life that this even should happen. And I feel so fortunate to be part of this community, and I look forward to many years of this being together with this community, with you, and see where we go with all this. It's a great trip. Thank you.